Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Hello, and welcome back. Today we're going to talk about space travel and how Einstein's discoveries have both constrained and enabled long-distance space travel. As usual, we have some great images for you on our website, so open a second window, go to guidetothecosmos.com, click on the microphone icon, which will bring up a menu of radio shows, and select today's show, Einstein and Space Travel. Let's start off with an interesting tidbit about travel on Earth. That actually doesn't have much to do with Einstein, but it's still pretty curious. We could get from anywhere on Earth to any other place on Earth in only 42 minutes and 13 seconds, and without having to expend any energy at all, if only we had a tunnel straight through the Earth connecting those two points. If we took two points that were very far apart, then the tunnel would run close to the center of the Earth. We would lose an enormous amount of gravitational potential energy falling down through the tunnel that close to the center of the Earth, and that would give us a very high velocity. We would exit the tunnel at the other side when our velocity returned to zero. So we would accelerate all the way down through the first half of the tunnel and then decelerate out toward the surface again, and arrive in 42 minutes and 13 seconds. If the two points that we were traveling between were much closer, then the tunnel wouldn't go very deep, we wouldn't accelerate to a very high velocity, and so we would travel through the tunnel at a much lower velocity, which would compensate exactly for its much shorter distance. And again, we would emerge in 42 minutes and 13 seconds. And this is true because gravity is an inverse square law. And we have also assumed that the Earth has a uniform density. Now let's shift our attention to traveling away from the Earth. Einstein put a major constraint on long-distance space travel when he asserted that nothing could travel faster than the speed of light. Since the nearest major galaxy, Andromeda, is 2.5 million light-years away, that means that we're never going to be able to mount a round-trip voyage to that galaxy that would last less than 5 million years. Obviously, much longer than the life of any astronaut. So the dreams that we all had when we watched Star Trek of being able to go off at warp speed to the Delta Quadrant and come back in time for dinner, those dreams really don't make any sense at all. And image number one on the website gives us a quantitative feeling of why this is true. Now, according to Newton, regardless of how fast you were going, you could always go faster just by adding more energy. And in fact, what you would need to do to go 1% faster is add 2% more energy, since the kinetic energy is proportional to the square of the velocity. Einstein said, well, this is true, but only at velocities that are much less than the speed of light. For example, if we were going at 90% of the speed of light, and we wanted to accelerate to 91% of the speed of light, we would have to add 5% to our energy, not 2%. And if we were going at 98% of the speed of light, and we wanted to get to 99% of the speed of light, that's 1% faster, we would have to increase our energy by 41%, much more than the 2% that Newton had said. And if we were going at 99% of the speed of light, well, Einstein said we can't increase it by 1% to 100% of the speed of light, but let's say we try to increase it to 99.99% of the speed of light, then Einstein said we would have to increase our energy by 997%. So that means that the energy required to go at 99.99% of the speed of light is about 11 times more than the energy required to get to only 99% of the speed of light. And indeed, the energy required to get to 100% of the speed of light for any massive object would be infinity. It would take an infinite amount of energy to accelerate any massive object up to the speed of light. And since there isn't an infinite amount of energy to do that with, nothing that's massive can travel at the speed of light. Conversely, things that have no mass must travel at the speed of light, no faster and no slower. Now let's talk about what a travel to deep space might consist of. Well, we can imagine blasting off the surface of the Earth, accelerating at some amount. Let's say we accelerate at 1G. So the crew would feel the normal gravity and be comfortable. We could use some other velocity, but it turns out that that doesn't make a lot of difference, so let's pick the one that's the most comfortable. We will accelerate for a period of time at 1G. Then, if we want, we can turn off the engines and save some fuel and coast. And eventually, when we get close to our destination, we'll have to decelerate. Let's say, again, we're going to decelerate at 1G so that we come to a stop, for example, on the surface of a distant planet. To get home, we would have to accelerate off the planet. Then we could coast again if we wish, and then finally decelerate to land back on Earth. So we have four segments of the trip which involve acceleration and deceleration, where we have to turn the engines on, and perhaps two sections of the trip which we're coasting with the engines off. Now, coasting is something that's easy to figure out. The hard part here is to figure out what it takes in terms of fuel and in terms of time to accelerate. So that's going to happen four times if we have a round-trip voyage. And to understand what's going to happen during those periods, we have the second image on our website, which is called Space Travel Best Case. And by best case, what I mean here is we've assumed the best possible engineering implementation of future space travel that is consistent with the known laws of physics. And I'm in no way representing that this is possible, only that this is the most optimistic possible scenario. So first of all, we're going to assume that we have an engine capable of delivering 100% fuel efficiency. Current engines deliver less than one part in a billion in terms of fuel efficiency. So we need to do at least a billion times better in our engine design to get to the very best case. This would probably require antimatter fuel. We're also going to assume that there's no refueling stations along the way and that we will have a comfortable acceleration of 1G equal to Earth's gravity. Now, as the table shows, there are listed here four options. The first column shows us how many years will have elapsed for the crew within the rocket for the acceleration phase. The second column shows us how many years will have elapsed on Earth time for this acceleration phase. The third column shows us what is the maximum velocity that we get to at the end of the acceleration phase, or equivalently, from what velocity can you decelerate to zero within that time period if it's a decelerating phase. The fourth column shows us the relativistic factor G that would pertain to that maximum velocity. The fifth column tells us how much fuel we're going to use in terms of a multiple of the payload. So if we are going to deliver 1 ton of payload, astronaut plus everything the astronaut needs, including food and air and liquid, then that column tells us how much more than that the fuel will have to weigh. And the last column tells us what distance we will have traveled during this acceleration or deceleration phase. So if we look at the first line, we see the example where the crew has been accelerating on their own clock for 1.3 years, about 16 months. That journey would have taken 1.8 years as seen from the Earth, the difference being due to time dilation. The rocket would have reached a maximum velocity of 87% of the speed of light, and the maximum relativistic gamma factor, the green G listed there, would be 2. The amount of fuel consumed during this acceleration would have been 2.8 times the final payload. So if the rocket weighed 10 tons at the end of this acceleration, we would have consumed 28 tons of fuel to get it there. And the distance that the rocket would have traveled would be approximately 1 light year. Now on the next line, which is shown in green, if we accelerate at 1G for 3 years of crew clock time, that would take 10 years of Earth clock time, and the rocket would get to 99.5% of the speed of light. The fuel consumption would be 19 tons of fuel per ton of payload, and we would have reached a distance from Earth of 9 light years. The next line in yellow shows that if we continue for 6 years on the cruise clock, 202 years would have elapsed on Earth because of the relativistic time dilation, and we would see that the rocket would get to a velocity of 99.999 of the speed of light. That's a total of 5 nines. The fuel consumption would be 400 tons per ton of payload, and the rocket would have traveled a distance during those 6 years of the cruise life of 201 light years. The 201 light years that they've traveled is enormously greater than the 6 years that's been consumed from their clocks and their lives because, again, of the relativistic time dilation factor. On Earth, we see them take 202 years, so from Earth's perspective, the speed of light has not been violated. And the last line shows an even more aggressive case in which we let the crew accelerate at 1G for 8.3 years on their clock. That would be 2,012 years on Earth's time, and they would get to 99.99999% of the speed of light. That was a total of 7 nines. The fuel consumption in this case would have been 4,023 times the final payload, and the rocket would have traveled 2,011 light years during this period. It seems impossible to imagine that with all of the financial stress our country has, that Congress would ever approve the cost of a journey that would take over 2,000 years on Earth. That is over 500 presidential election cycles. Now, I would not recommend exceeding the figure that we see here for 6 years of acceleration on the cruise clock, getting to a velocity of 99.999% of the speed of light. And that is because the relativistic factor that you get to is 200. That green G, the gamma factor of relativity, gets to 202, actually. And the reason that this is a concern is that the universe is filled with the cosmic microwave background radiation. And as you go faster and faster, that energy is going to appear to be coming at you at an ever higher energy. At a relativistic factor of 202, the energy of that cosmic microwave background radiation would be over 500 degrees Kelvin. And if you push things much further than that, you'll start to melt the surface of the rocket. Now, one can take the data in this table and use it to construct any deep space voyage that you care to. The table gives you directly the figures that you need for each of the acceleration and deceleration phases. And if you have any coasting period, then that's easy to figure out from the table as well. So let's take the example that you had gotten to 99.5% of the speed of light after 3 years on the cruise clock, accelerating at 1G. Coasting for 5 years, according to the cruise clock, which would correspond to coasting for 50 years on an Earth clock, the rocket would have traveled the distance of just under 50 light years, 49¾ light years, at the velocity of 99.5% of the speed of light. Let's take some specific examples on image number 3 on the website. Assuming again 100% fuel efficiency, which is more than a 1 billion fold improvement in engine design, and assuming that we don't go faster than 99.999% of the speed of light because of the concern of melting the spaceship with the cosmic microwave background radiation, then we have three voyages that are listed here. The first case illustrated here takes 7 years on the cruise clock for the entire round trip, 12 years on Earth clocks, and we would have traveled one-way distance of 4 light years and returned to Earth. The fuel consumption would be 1,300 tons per ton of payload. So if we had 10 tons of astronauts, food, liquid, and air, we would need 13,000 tons of payload even with a 100% fuel efficiency. The second line shows us what would happen for a 12-year round trip on the cruise clock. It would take 44 years on Earth clocks, and the fuel consumption would be a staggering 233,000 tons of fuel per ton of delivered payload. And we would get out to a distance of 20 light years and back. And I chose that example because that is the distance to the nearest planet that we've seen so far which has any resemblance to the planet Earth. I'm not saying it's as good as the planet Earth. Most likely it's far less habitable than Earth, but at least it seems to be a planet in the habitable zone of its star with approximately a similar mass to Earth. So at least that gives us a shot. No other planet has been seen which is anywhere close to being that good, and most of them are much farther away. So this is a great new discovery. The last line on the chart shows what would happen if we kept this trip up for 40 years on the cruise clock, and that would end up being 4,040 years on Earth clocks. The amount of fuel required would be an incredible 25 billion tons of fuel for every ton of payload. And the fuel we're talking about to get this sort of efficiency is probably antimatter. So far, we haven't even made a gram of antimatter, and to get here, we would need 25 billion tons, even for a measly 1 ton of payload. And if we did, we would get to a distance of 2,000 light years and return. That would allow us to explore less than about 0.5% of our own galaxy. Now let's say we weren't talking about a round trip. Let's say our interest was in colonizing a distant planet, and so it would only need to be a one-way trip. Again, we'll start off assuming as we have above, and here we see that with 12 years of the cruise clock and 22 years elapsed on Earth, we were to reach the distance of 20 light years and be able to land on that planet that we talked about. The fuel consumption would be about 480 tons of fuel for every ton of delivered payload. So it would get to be quite expensive to deliver more than one or two astronauts. If we had to go further, let's say as far out as 2,000 light years to find a habitable planet, then that would take 20 years of the crew's life, and 2,020 years would have elapsed on Earth, and the fuel consumption would be 160,000 tons of fuel for every 1 ton of payload. Currently, with the space shuttle, we're spending about $250,000 for each ton that leaves the launch pad. So the notion that we would have 160,000 tons for every ton of payload at $250,000 each is a pretty staggering expense. And even that is wildly optimistic because we again need to make a 1 billion-fold improvement in energy efficiency, which can probably only be attained by using antimatter fuel, which will be vastly more expensive than the fuel we're using today. Now, the third one-way trip that's illustrated here involves no colonization and no possibility of the crew surviving. This is a 70-year voyage from the crew's standpoint, which shoots straight out into space. There will not be any fuel on board to make any returns, to make any stops, or even to slow down and linger as one passes a likely-looking solar system. This is strictly a one-shot, catch-everything-you-can-see-as-you-go-by journey. It would take 4,500 years of elapsed time on the Earth's clock, and if we keep the velocity down to 99.9% of the speed of light, that's three nines, it would require only 45 tons of fuel per ton of payload. The notion here is that as the crew zips by whatever stars and planets happen to be en route, and again, they can't turn as they go by to take a closer look, they'll gather whatever data they can and send us back a little pod with something like a USB drive that tells us everything that they've discovered along the way. Again, there's no possibility of the crew surviving the voyage because there's no fuel for them to slow down and land anywhere. So traveling through space looks to be extraordinarily expensive and also extraordinarily limited in terms of how far we could imagine ourselves getting, even in the very best possible scenario. You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's guidetothecosmos.com.
We're back. You're listening to Guide to the Cosmos. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and today we're talking about space travel and how Einstein's discoveries both constrained and enabled long-distance space travel. What about traveling through time? What if we wanted to go into the future? Is that a possibility? Well, yes, actually, that's quite easy to do because of Einstein's theory that time slows down for rapidly moving objects. So if an astronaut got into a rocket ship, blasted off from the surface of the Earth, accelerated up to 99.5% of the speed of light, then coasted for a period of time, decelerated, re-accelerated to head back toward Earth, coasted again, and then decelerated to land on the Earth, then because of the time dilation factor, much more time would have elapsed on Earth than in the astronaut's reference frame. So his clock would run slower, his heart would beat slower, he would live longer, and he would end up returning in our distant future. So there are several examples given here, all of which will end up consuming 160,000 tons of fuel for every 1 ton of astronaut food, liquid, and air that we need to supply him with. So if the round trip took 12 years, then 20 years would have passed on Earth, and he would be 8 years younger than the people of his own age that he left behind. If 20 years elapsed on the astronaut's clock, then 100 years would have elapsed on Earth, and he would return, and probably most of the people that he knew when he left would have passed away by then. He would have jumped 100 years into the future at the cost of spending 20 years in his spacecraft. If he spent 30 years in the spacecraft, he would come back in 200 Earth years. 40 years in the spacecraft, and he would come back in 300 Earth years. 50 years in the spacecraft, and he would come back 4 centuries into the future. These are the possibilities in the very most optimistic scenario. Now let's talk about wormholes. Some people have suggested that rather than going through the mundane process of simply traveling through space, maybe we could find a way of finding a shortcut between here and where we want to go, and shortcut those vast distances in the cosmos. This scenario is illustrated on image number 6 on the website. It's called an Einstein-Rosen bridge, or more commonly referred to as a wormhole. In this illustration, we've shown space as being a two-dimensional surface, and the notion is that perhaps we can drill a hole from one location in space to another, or find a hole that has already been established, and take the shortcut through the hole rather than the long way around through the space that we actually see. So it's sort of like a sheet that's been folded over, with a shortcut being a tunnel, if you will, between the upper and lower surfaces of the sheet, which represents our two-dimensional space. There's a point illustrated A on the upper sheet and B on the lower sheet, and one can either travel through the entire distance within the sheet, which is a very long distance, or travel the much shorter distance through the shortcut, through the tunnel, the wormhole that joins A and B. Now, Einstein-Rosen pertains to a comment that was made in a paper by Einstein and Rosen about black holes, and they indicated that there was the possibility of the black hole curving in to a singular point and then curving out the other side, whatever the other side means, really, in a symmetric way and opening up into a different part of the universe. In their concept, this bridge existed only for a single instant in time. The bridge narrowed down to a single point in the middle, and so there was no realistic way, and from their point of view, that anything could get through that bridge, certainly not in any survivable means. Since Einstein and Rosen proposed such a notion, science fiction writers and even some physicists have imagined that maybe we could expand on their suggestion and find a way to broaden the tunnel width, to enlarge the wormhole, and to keep it open for a reasonable length of time so that we could make a transit through it. The only way that anyone has suggested that we might be able to accomplish this is by supplying an incredibly large amount of something they call negative energy. Now let me hasten to add that this negative energy doesn't correspond to anything that's been observed, that's been measured, or even been seriously proposed by any mainstream physicist. The notion solely is that any form of normal energy, which is positive, has positive gravity and would cause the hole to collapse. If there were such a thing as negative energy, it would have negative gravity and it would force the hole to remain open. A sample calculation indicates that if you wanted to maintain a wormhole of 3 feet in diameter open for just long enough for a spacecraft to shoot through, you would have to have an amount of negative energy that corresponded to the mass of Jupiter, but of course the mass of Jupiter has positive energy. You'd have to have that amount of energy, but with the opposite polarity. Now let me also hasten to add that negative energy is certainly not dark energy. Whereas dark energy does have repulsive gravity, the density of dark energy is exceedingly low, vastly too little to hold up open any wormhole of any physically interesting size, and there's no way of concentrating dark energy because it is a property of space itself. So this is completely a fantasy. But if indeed you grant them the fantasy for a moment, then indeed one would be able to travel from one place in space and time on the upper sheet to another place in space and time on the lower sheet. That could allow you to almost instantly appear in the Andromeda Galaxy, grab lunch, and come back. Now let's talk about using such a wormhole, in principle at least, to make a trip back to the past. Now let's talk about using this fantasy of a wormhole to travel backwards in time. We said earlier that traveling forwards in time is certainly no problem, given you're willing to buy enough fuel. How about traveling backwards in time, using the wormhole? Well, if a wormhole were constructed, then one can imagine moving one of the two mouths around to a different space and a different time, and then you would be linking two different times. You would be able to travel, therefore, forward in time in one direction and backward in time in the other direction. But it's been established that you would never be able to travel further backwards in time than the moment that this wormhole was established. So if we were to discover or create a wormhole today, then we would never be able to travel backwards in time to a time earlier than today. However, several centuries from now, we might be able to come back to today. One of the key problems with traveling backwards in time is that you can generate a lot of very troubling paradoxes. For example, if you went back 10 years in time and killed yourself, what would that mean? If you really could kill yourself 10 years ago, then you wouldn't exist today to travel backwards in time to kill yourself. So that means you would exist today, and then you could travel in time to kill yourself. So it's a closed loop with an inconsistent result. That probably indicates there's something fundamentally, physically unrealistic about traveling backwards in time. Now, Leslie, let's talk about moving through space-time, the four dimensions of space-time, three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. And this is illustrated in image number 7 on the website. An object which is stationary from our point of view has zero velocity, as shown on the left of the three images in image number 7, and so it proceeds directly forward in time at a normal rate. An object which moves at the speed of light, let's say a photon, is moving at the highest possible speed through space, and in the reference frame of the photon itself, there really is no such thing as time. Time does not elapse at all. Nothing ever changes. From the point of view of a photon, it may be created, travel across the universe, and be absorbed, and all of that would appear to the photon to be happening simultaneously. So this corresponds to the right-hand image in image number 7, where we see the object moving directly to the right and not moving forward in time at all. Everything else is something in between, as illustrated in the middle image. And here we see that for a given velocity, time is dilated by a certain amount, meaning that the object sees time flowing more slowly. And if you run through the math, you find out that the length that it moves through space-time is exactly the same amount in all three of the different images on the website. The faster something moves through space, the slower it moves through time, and the total velocity, if you will, through space-time is always the same. Everything we see moves through space-time at the speed of light. Thank you very much for joining us today. And remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.